Housekeeping real quick. If every single one of you could please check your cell phones, turn them off, turn off anything that...
No, that's you can actually leave those on. You can leave your cell phones on, but if they ring, you have to let me speak to whoever's calling. And don't call people on Tom.
You can take pictures whenever you like. It's not having pictures taken.
Happy is a strong word, but it's a Tom word. Yes. Go ahead. I won't interrupt again. Go ahead.
No problem. Bathrooms go that way, and then back to the, that would be the right. And that's where the bathrooms are. If you use one right on the street, or just run over everybody since it looks like there's no easy way out.
Once you're in the bathroom, you no longer need to be discreet.
And so, I think we're about ready for you to, actually magically know where you are. Instead of ruining the image.
No, you don't.
Okay.
Yeah, John.
Go ahead, bam.
Have you tuned? You should tune your guitar, Jimmy. Yeah, I'm waiting for your coffee.
Okay.
Is the coffee here?
To your right.
This is my first time ever doing that. Oh, there it is.
Yeah.
I guess we're just waiting for Jonathan. Sorry? Oh, I thought you said, I hope he's good. Wow. They don't have any C batteries? Title is as follows. An almanac, complete world knowledge, compiled with instructive annotation, and arranged in useful order by me, John Hodgman, a professional writer in the areas of my expertise, which areas include matters historical, matters literary, matters cryptozoological, hobo matters, food, drink, and cheese, which is a kind of food, lobsters, squirrels, eels, haircuts, utopia, what will happen in the future, and most other subjects.
Most other subjects include asthma, tubing and fancy hotel, terrible haircuts, monsters and magical spells. All of your travels are finally over. You're safe now, there's nothing to fear. So sit back a glass of your favorite beverage. You're lucky to be here. Cause tonight, I'm holding your key. Fits in a lock, opens the door, shows you a room. It's holding your heart, it's pumping the blood, it's feeding your brain. Sweet information.
Jonathan Golden, ladies and
gentlemen.
Jonathan Golden has several plates screwed into his skull that sometimes affects the speakers. Beautiful. It was not always this way. A long time ago, I was a professional literary agent and high-powered media insider whose job it was to decide the fates of young novelists every day, yay or nay, often while playing bocce, my favorite game, usually while drunk, on fine brandy provided to me by the nation's publishers. It was a perfect existence. But as it is our common destiny as we grow older to become that which we most loathe, so I have become that most loathsome thing, a writer. I am sorry about this. I was not looking forward to it, but it was bound to happen. But back when I was a literary agent, people would come to me for advice all the time about how to be a successful author of books. What sort of books should I write, they would ask. How do I get them published? What do I need in order to be a successful writer? And I would always answer in the same way. You need a few things. You need the ability to endure solitude, because writing is a lonely craft. You need to be able to convince yourself that the world has to hear what you have to say. This comes naturally to some people. Some people automatically believe that the world has to hear what they have to say. These people are assholes. They are not typically very good writers either. You need special stationery, obviously, with your name at the top, and it should say professional writer on it. And then I would add, like, a picture of a typewriter or a quill in an ink. You know, if you want publishers to take you seriously. And obviously, you need a literary theme. Did you hear that? Say it again?
A cyborg.
A cyborg. You are? We're going to be hearing a lot of strange things today. Is this the most haunted codes in all of San Francisco? You also need a literary theme song. All great writers used to have literary theme songs. William Faulkner, of course, had the love theme from The Sound and the Fury, which called for a chamber quartet and a chorus of idiot man-children. Obviously, not many people have heard of William Faulkner these days, but the song is still an enormous hit at weddings, if you can find the idiot man-children. Many a union has been blessed by their bellowing. Edgar Allan Poe was a poet and composed his own theme song, The Eye of the Tiger, which, as you know, was later used as the theme song for the movie Rocky III, handpicked by Sylvester Stallone, our nation's greatest Poe enthusiast, which is a true fact, perhaps the last true fact you will hear this evening. You may look it up if you wish, not now, not now. Oh, hello. How are you? And you just heard Jonathan playing my theme song. I don't know why writers don't have more theme songs these days, because they're not very hard to get. Obviously, you can convince a singer-songwriter to write almost anything for, like, some nuts and berries. The hard thing is to find a troubadour who will follow you around from town to town to sing your theme song. I found Jonathan wandering in the woods of southern Connecticut, a feral mountain man who had been raised by woodland creatures. And he looked, you know, terribly rustic like this then, and he wore this shirt that he made out of the chickadees that had raised him. He didn't even speak English at the time. He just spoke a kind of click language of his own devising. But I could see that he had talent. He was already clicking away on some very beautiful literary theme songs out there in the woods, and he already knew how to play guitar. He had already learned how to play guitar somehow. You know, of course he didn't call it guitar. Some sort of onomatopoeia, right? Yeah. But I thought he had potential, so I brought him back to civilization, and I shaved him as best I could. I'm all here for you now, and now he speaks English well, almost like an English speaker. Is that right, John?
Yes. Thank you.
Astonishing, isn't it?
I appreciate, ladies and gentlemen, your kind attention. Okay. Thank you.
Once that rudimentary mouth shape gets going. My book is a book of trivia. This is a copy of my book, and so is this. I will note the differences between these two later, but see if you can spot them. Like a game. It is an almanac, a compendium, complete world knowledge, very much like the old Book of Lists or People's Almanac or Donati's Extraordinary Origin of Everyday Things or Ripley's Believe It or Not, all those crackpot reference books from the 70s and 80s that I love, so. And indeed, all of their almanacian predecessors from before them, the North American Almanac, the Old Farmer's Almanac, World of Wisdom, Old Werewolf's Almanac. It's a long publishing tradition, but the distinction with mine is a brand new kind of almanac, because it is distinguished by the fact that all of the fascinating trivia and historical oddities and amazing true facts in my book are made up by me, and thus allowed to be more truthful. Truth is stranger than fiction, goes the old saw, but never as strange as lies. Proof of which maxim is the fact that I just made it. Probably the oldest almanac in the American publishing tradition goes back to a time before there was the United States. Poor Richard's Almanac came out and was America's first bestseller. The New World's first bestseller was Poor Richard's Almanac. It was not written by Poor Richard. There was no one named Poor Richard. There was someone named Benjamin Franklin, and he was extremely wealthy, not poor at all. And he wrote under that name, presumably because he had things to hide. That is why we know him as America's most shiftiest founding father. Okay. I see the anti-Franklinites. And he also included in the almanac, in addition to the traditional dubious meteorological information, bits of folklore, scraps of poetry, a lot of pushy maxims telling you how many pennies to save. I found it to be not a very good book myself. I found the product placement to be too much. Franklin was really pushing the bifocals very hard. I guess stitch in time saves bifocals. It doesn't mean anything. And electric kites, he's advertising electric kites all the time as well. But he did include in the book one thing, aside from mistressing, that was very interesting, and this was the Six Oaths of a Virtuous Child. Now, this is not something that he wrote, rather, it is something that he took from the American schoolhouse at the time. It was something that was recited, obviously, long before there was a Pledge of Allegiance, back during a time when American education mainly meant standing in front of a wood stove and being hit. Now, I'd like to begin the evening by reciting it. There may be some elderly among you who might recall it, but for the rest, I will lead you and in the words, and I will say them, and then all you have to do is repeat what I say when I indicate thus. We'll try it again. When I indicate thusly. That's good. But you have to be louder. Pretend you're standing by a wood stove being hit. This is my first time I've ever done this with a laugh.
How does it sound?
Today shall not be wasted.
Today shall not be wasted.
Right, let's try to get it together. I shall rise before the sun.
I shall rise before the sun.
So that I may then watch my family as they slumber.
So that I may then watch my family as they slumber.
With intent waiting eyes.
With intent waiting eyes.
I shall honor my mother today.
I shall honor my mother today.
And I shall tell father he is powerful.
And I shall tell father he is powerful.
Today I shall be clean.
Today I shall be clean.
I shall not touch my teeth.
I shall not touch my teeth.
Knowing that the oils of my skin shall cause them to disintegrate.
Knowing that the oils of my skin shall cause them to disintegrate.
That's not true, by the way. That's not true. Go ahead and touch your teeth. You have no oils in your skin. I shall instead sharpen them with a good steel twice after prayers.
I shall instead sharpen them with a good steel twice after prayers.
I shall be a faithful child.
I shall be a faithful child.
And I shall ever make science my enemy.
I shall ever make science my enemy.
Also eels.
Also eels.
At day I shall perform my chores and duties happily.
At day I shall perform my chores and duties happily.
And if I see an eel, I shall kill it.
And if I see an eel, I shall kill it.
At night I shall dream of more labor.
At night I shall dream of more labor.
And in my sleep I shall smile with sharpened teeth.
And in my sleep I shall smile with sharpened teeth.
Knowing that today has not been wasted.
Knowing that today has not been wasted.
Very good. You guys really pulled it together. Again, throw yourselves a round of applause. Thank you. If you had applauded afterward in colonial era schoolhouses, you would have been burned. I noted before there are two versions of my book. There are small differences between them. One of them is very hard. This is old. This is garbage now. It's a bad habit that I read from. Throw it away, sir. Buy two of these. You see, this is the new paperback edition of my book, which was just published. We had to do a paperback edition. When the hardcover came out, college students and people from high school and also people from the Pacific Northwest were coming to me and saying, your book is too expensive in hardcover. I'm a poor college student or person from the Pacific Northwest. I cannot afford it since I have to buy so much marijuana. And so we came out with the soft cover edition, which as you can see is much more flexible and is less expensive. And so I hope the students will appreciate it because it is less expensive and it can be much more easily rolled up into a hash pipe. So there you go. Yes. It also afforded me the opportunity to offer some additional complete world knowledge that I discovered between the two editions. I'm sure you have received the same news that I have, that there have been some changes at the Mall of America since I last visited. I visited the Mall of America long before the hardcover edition, back when I was just a magazine writer and a food columnist. I had been assigned to go report on what was going down at the food court at the Mall of America, and I discovered some fascinating differences between the orange chicken at the Panda Express in the North Court versus the orange chicken at the Panda Express in the South Court. Some distinct differences in terroir that were really interesting. And I also discovered some other fascinating and surprising things about the Mall of America, which I reported in the hardcover edition of my book. But one of the things that has changed when I have used the paperback edition as an excuse to update is the fact that the amusement park in the Mall of America is no longer called Camp Snoopy. Did you read about this? Yes, this gentleman nods. Are you a Minnesotan? No? Are you some sort of Charles Schultz freak or something? I'm glad you're with me on this. You can verify that it is true, right? It used to be called Camp Snoopy, and it was themed to Charlie Brown and Peanuts. And so, you know, you'd have pictures of characters wandering around and so forth. And then they lost that license, so they had to scrub from the park all reference to Charlie Brown and Snoopy and Peanuts. So, for example, certain rides, like the kite-eating tree, based on Charlie Brown, the tree that always ate Charlie Brown's kites. Kite-eating tree ride was renamed the tree swing ride. The Red Baron attacks ride was renamed the Menacing German. And sadly, all of the 8-year-old children who had been hired to wander the park on states of existential dread, philosophy, and politics and coded terms were all fired. They now live sort of as a pack together in a tent in parking lot 2035 in Mall of America, where they regularly harass shoppers. You may have read about this. They regularly harass shoppers with blankets and quotations from the Book of Luke. But otherwise, all of the information that was contained in my original hardcover edition of my book regarding the Mall of America is accurate, up to date, and totally truthful, except the parts that I made up. It takes the form of a diamond. Day one. At 200 million square feet, the Mall of America is the largest mall in the United States. In addition to 520 shops, two-thirds of which are devoted to the sale of NYPD baseball caps, it has a chapel and a school and a post office and an amusement park formerly called Camp Snoopy inside of it. It is not, I should point out, the largest mall in North America. That distinction belongs to the West Edmonton Mall of Canada, which contains 7,000 baseball cap shops, a sausage factory, a complete medieval castle, 12 monorails, and the entire township of East Edmonton, preserved like Pompeii at the exact moment that it was devoured. Still, the Mall of America is very large, so large that I can actually see it from my hotel window, literally hundreds of feet away. Its phosphor lights obliterate the Minnesota evening, and I do not know how they get the giant bats to keep circling. Day two. The Mall of America is filled with elderly people who are always walking, circling the mall like sharks. They say, for exercise. When they collapse, mall security discreetly removes them and props them up in the booths at Johnny Rockets, leaves them there to their fate. One elderly woman has agreed to show me her favorite places to eat in the mall. Her name is Elaine. She takes me to the Odyssey Cafe. It is a restaurant with four dining rooms, each devoted to the style of a lost civilization. I am not very impressed with the Atlantis room, I have to say, which is just a blue room with pictures of fish in it, not a single picture of a merman or porthole, which to me just seems obvious. But the Machu Picchu room is stunning, with beautiful murals and mountaintops, and the air is very thin, and it is difficult to breathe in it. All the hard-boiled eggs are underfoot. And in fact, the room is also staffed by actual Incas, looking sad and doing their sad little math with knots of string when they are not serving you omelets. Elaine says, this is all that remains of the once great civilization. Day three. The Minnesota Picnic is a stand in the North Food Court that is run by three brothers, all of them Egyptian. They serve traditional favorites of the Minnesota State Fair. Fried pike on a stick, corn dogs on a stick, deep-fried cheese curd, and bamya makluka, the famous Egyptian okra stew, which unfortunately cannot be served on a stick. The brothers implore me to try their new invention, deep-fried cheesecake on a stick, which is all old news to you people now, I appreciate. But at the time, it was a stunning innovation in food on a stick technology. They then admit that they are sad like the Incas are sad. After 10 years in the Mall of America, their lease is not being renewed, and the mall refuses to return their calls and explain why. They are being kicked out. I ask if maybe they are being discriminated against because they are Egyptian. This was very soon after 9/11. That's why I ask these things. We always ask those things at the time. Oh no, they say. Oh no. No. Day four. I call the mall's PR people and ask why they're exiling the Egyptians, and also to ask about the secret tunnel I have found that leads from the amusement park to the Pottery Barn and is lined with human skulls. This is when the Mall of America stops returning my calls. It happens sometimes when journalists ask the hard questions. I have been frozen out. From here on in, I'm going in rogue. Day five. Elaine takes me to the Serial Adventure, which is a miniature theme park run by General Mills, makers of Trix and Lucky Charms. There's a miniature golf course, as well as an interactive exhibit on how Lucky Charms are made. Here it is shown how the leprechauns are first flayed and then pulped into the marshmallows. Off to the side are waist-high piles of little green hats that are to be returned to Ireland under special treaty. Am I the only one here who finds this creepy, I ask aloud? But Elaine ignores me. You can have your picture taken and put on a box of Wheaties, she says. That's insane, I said. I can't masturbate to a picture of myself. Where are the Mary Lou Retton boxes? We then go to the Cereal Adventure Cafe, which claims to have all the General Mills cereals for sale. They have the Monster cereals, Blueberry, Count Chocula, and Frankenberry. But I am surprised to learn they have never heard of the cereal called Fruit Brute, which you will remember was a fruit cereal based on a werewolf. They have never even heard of a cereal called Yummy Mummy, which was a mummy that was fruit flavored. And I wonder whether they really have any business running a cereal adventure cafe at all, frankly. Those are true cereals. Are there any other children here before I read all the books? Day 6. My last interview is with a Minnesota woman who just opened a pastry shop using her grandmother's cheesecake recipe. Her store is called A La Mode. I asked her if she's tried the deep-fried cheesecake on a stick that the Egyptians are serving over at the Minnesota picnic, and she just smiles in an eerie way that makes me think that she knows their days are numbered, and soon she will be cheesecake queen of the mall. Working in the mall is a little nerve-wracking, she confides to me, because as the largest mall in the United States, we are a prime target for terrorism. You know what I say? Fuck you. Day 7. My 3-day journey is complete. I check in with one of the Egyptian brothers on my way out of the Mall of America. Did you ever discover why they are kicking us out, he asks. No, I say. The mall officials are stonewalling me. I have gone rogue, I explain. He nods as only a sad Egyptian about to lose his deep-fried palace at the Mall of America can nod. Perhaps, he says, this is for the best. He gives me something fried on a stick, and I promise to eat it someday. But for now, and for me, and for him, the Minnesota picnic. Thank you very much. All that is not true, I have to say. Someday I'll explain all the truth. We now come to the portion of the program devoted to hobo matters. The hobo material in the book was actually not supposed to be in the book at all, interestingly enough. It was originally going to be a PBS documentary that Jonathan and I were putting together. We were pitching it to PBS as a kind of like a Ken Burns style documentary. Now, it'd start with an old antique photo of a hobo from the Great Depression jumping onto a box. And Jonathan would play some annoying folk music. And I would narrate the history of the hobos from the Great Depression. And the camera would pan very slowly over the photograph, like this, as I spoke. And then Jonathan would play some more folk music, and would come around and start panning this way, the actual the same photograph. It was just going to be one photograph. The entire documentary, 36-part series. It would be extremely cost-effective. I thought, frankly, it was a slam dunk, as they say, it's sports patois. But unfortunately, it was not to be. It turns out, and this surprised me, apparently, hobos do not show up on photographic film. So that kind of ruined the whole project. And so I decided to repurpose the script for the documentary in this book. But now that Jonathan is here and he has his guitar, we can at least reproduce for you what the soundtrack would have been. So you can just close your eyes and listen and pretend that you're falling asleep in front of PBS. Which I'm sure you're very used to anyway. And listen to these hobo matters. They called it the war to end all wars. They called it the London Fire and the Trail of Tears. But they were all wrong. It was called the Great Depression. And the hobos saw it coming. 1929, October, Black Thursday. the 24th day of October, 1929. The day of the stock market crash, instantly wiping out $30 billion in stock value. Soon after, the Bank of the United States would collapse, trapping all inside, many of them orphans. After a decade of high-flying prosperity, the United States economy fell to earth and began tunneling to an awful volcanic core of despair, food riots, annoying folk songs, and lava. By March, a 250,000 apple sellers would crowd the streets of Manhattan, desperately refusing to sell any other kind of fruit. But apples and sellers alike were easy picking for the hobos. There had been hobos in the United States since the time there had been trains and liquor, which is to say, always. But by 1930, an estimated 2 million broken souls had taken to the wandering life, popping boxcars, picking up work where they could find it, wearing the same pants every day, and drinking. In many ways, they were a nation unto themselves. They had their own currency in the form of hobo nickels, which were ordinary buffalo nickels that the hobo would redecorate with a penknife and carve in new little figures, taking a buffalo nickel, for example, and changing it to look like a hobo dressed as a buffalo. They had their own crafts. They were very fond of lint knitting. Hobo was fascinated by lint and would stare at it for hours. And he would go from town to town and pull pills off of sweaters that had been left outside. He would knit those pills into new sweaters and attempt to resell them to the original owner. Many deranged schemes there. And of course, the hobos had their own language, a system of scrawled hieroglyphics chalked onto barn sides and picket fences, little icons that the hobo would leave for the next hobo to come along and indicate to him areas of opportunity or of danger. So, for example, a cross on the side of a house would indicate that religious talk would get you a good meal at that house. Or a stick figure of a woman surrounded with three triangles next to her would mean a woman lives here alone with her children, or alternately, a woman lives here who is very fond of triangles. Three stars would mean, obviously, that the hobo should watch out because the sheriff in that town is very good with throwing stars, also known as the hobo's bane, have the hobo dread of the sheriff. And then, of course, there was this this symbol, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. The capital H, surrounded by sun rays, for those of you in the distant back who don't know the letter H, was seen throughout the United States almost simultaneously and everywhere in 1932, chalked onto boxcars, chalked onto the backs of policemen's uniforms, carved into the mashed potatoes at diners, and plowed in gigantic scale into wheat fields like a great crop circle, presumably to be seen by the hobos above. No one knew what it meant except for the hobos, who certainly knew that it meant just this. It was time for the hobos to rise up and take over the United States government, which they did. When in 1932 great masses of unemployed veterans descended upon Washington to urge the passing of the bonus bill, the hobos came with them. They took advantage of the chaos to infiltrate the White House and pocket sandwiches. They captured the Department of the Treasury and replaced Secretary of Treasury Ogden Mills with one of their own, Hobo Joe Junkman, to make our only hobo Secretary of the Treasury. And across the country, they began a coordinated reign of terror, soiling feather beds, salting cornfields, and dancing manic, heavy-footed jigs on parlor floors while ordinary citizens looked on in horror. They wrote semi-literate editorials to the newspapers, demanding cheap beer and warm hats. They wanted bent nails and pieces of string. They demanded half barrels of swallow feather sauce, and no one knew what they were talking about. Finally, in 1933, a new president came to the nation and promised a new deal against the hobos. FDR knew there was only one way to end the hobos' march across the blighted land: polio. The alone in his fireside lab, Roosevelt created a concentrated serum of the dreaded disease that will be placed in the nation's water supply by the newly formed Tennessee Valley Authority. According to his contemporaries, Roosevelt was tortured by this decision, knowing that a significant number of non-hobo citizens would spend the rest of their lives in iron lungs, not recreationally, as a result of his actions. But it would finally put a stop to the wandering people, beginning at their feet and ending at their waists. But then came Pearl Harbor. December 7th. Some say that Roosevelt knew the Japanese would attack that infamous morning. The truth is, he did not. The hobos did. As quickly as they came, the hobos mysteriously disappeared after Pearl Harbor. No one knows where they went or why. Some say they found patriotism in their hearts and joined America against their common enemy, Europe. Others say they went to another planet or to another dimension. And still others say they're still out there today, wandering around quietly from town to town, preparing for the day that their great moonshine and chicken bone empire may rise again. Is it possible? No. It's not possible. Most people who study this sort of thing agree that they probably went to another planet. But if you live near a railway track and listen as the train passes, it is almost as if you can still hear the hobos singing, the dark and lonely wind of history still blowing from their rotted lungs.
One evening as the sun went down and the jungle fires were burning, down the track came a hobo hiking. And he said, boys, I'm not turning. I'm headed for the land that's far away, beside the crystal fountain. I'll see you all this coming fall in the big rock candy mount.
I'm going to interrupt you. I'm sorry, John. Sorry. I just want to interrupt you. Maybe some people don't know, this song is the Big Rock Candy Mountain. It's a famous old American folk traditional. A lot of people think of it as a kid's song today. You hear it in movie soundtracks. You hear it in television advertisements for fast food franchises. But it's none of these things originally. Originally, it was a hobo song, perhaps the most famous hobo song describing the great hobo Valhalla, known as the Big Rock Candy Mountain. A place where all hobos would go someday, a place where handouts grew on bushes, and cigarettes grew on trees, and alcohol would flow down in streams from the mountain and fill up giant lakes of whiskey. Now, there would also be, according to the song, lakes of stew, which is disgusting. But that's what hobos like. Bushes of lint, giant bushes of lint as high as an elephant's eye. And the hobo would carve amazing topiary sculptures of hobos and buffalo nickels and bindle sticks out of them. Sculptures of elephants as high as their own arms. And if you listen to the lyrics of the song, that's what you'll hear. That's what the song is about. So I just wanted to interrupt briefly. I'm sorry. Now you can really enjoy the song. Okay, go ahead.
In the Big Rock Candy Mountain, there's a land that's fair and bright, and the handouts grow on bushes, and you sleep out every night. The boxcars are all empty, and the sun shines every day on the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings in the Big Rock Candy Mountain.
Sorry, I have to interrupt.
Okay, John.
I forgot about that. You heard John sing about the lemonade springs, and maybe you're confused now because, you know, you thought that the hobos hated lemonade. And it's true, they loathe lemonade more than anything else. But there's another reason why that lyric is in the song. You know, after I finished writing my book, I did some research on the hobos. And I discovered some true facts and some that were, frankly, pretty disturbing. And one disturbing true fact that I learned about hobo society during the Great Depression, that within this subculture, there was a smaller group of hobos who were called jockers, who liked to have young teenage boys go with them on the hobo road. These punks, as they were called, would do their begging for the hobo, and do work for the hobo, and do, as I read somewhere, other things for the hobo. And this song, a lot of folklorists believe, is actually a kind of kid's song, ironically, after all, a kind of Pied Piper tune. The hobo would sing as he passed through a town, hoping to lure with him children onto the hobo road by tempting the child with things that all children love, lemonade springs, soda water fountains, big rock candy mountains, and cigarette trees. After I learned all of this, and this is absolutely true and you can look it up, I went back and I found some other lyrics, some older lyrics to the song that you don't hear very much anymore. And Jonathan's going to sing them to you, and if you listen very closely, I think you'll find they tell a somewhat darker story. Okay, John, I won't interrupt you.
In the big rock candy mountains, you never change your socks, and little streams of alcohol come trickling down the rocks. So your socks get good and stinky, and you're always good and drunk. It's the bestest time that you've ever had. You won't miss your friends or your mom and dad at the big rock candy mountain. In the big rock candy mountain, there's a hole that's full of treats. And the rock salt tastes like sugar drops, and the dirt is nice and sweet. You can eat some as you work the mines to bring me precious gems. There's a hobo shed and some paint made of lead, and you know you're done a painting when you wake up dead. Well, the tender crisp bacon cheddar ranch, yes, they grow on trees, and streams of bacon ranch dressing flow right up to your knees. There's tumbleweed of bacon and cheddar paves the streets. You get to veg all day, all the lot of tickets paid. There's a king who wants you to have it your way at the tender crisp bacon cheddar. The tender crisp bacon cheddar. Come and get it.
Well, we now come to the portion of the program where Jonathan and I need a rest. We get very tired, we're not athletic people, and we need to take a rest and have some alcohol. There's a portion of the book that I cannot read for reasons that will become obvious. And luckier still, there is now an audio edition of the book where I don't have to read at all. So it just came out, it's on 6 CDs. One of which is devoted to hobo names. You can throw that one away or use it as a poster because you don't want to listen to that. And Dolores, you had put together a little package.
Right over there.
So while I get this technology set up for you so that you can hear the audiobook, Jonathan and I are going to have a drink of delicious brandy.
Okay. This is a sound reproducing device, and this is an amplification device. There's also a celebrity cameo in this portion of the program.
Comedians are notoriously superstitious, more so even than actors, who fear the word Macbeth so much they will attempt to stab anyone who dares speak or print it. This is why Shakespeare is dead now. Comedians, on the other hand, hate only themselves. That is why you will occasionally still hear these jokes, even though they supposedly curse the speaker to never hear laughter again. If you are hosting a dinner party or looking to pep up the speech to your coworkers, do not tell these jokes. I would also advise avoiding them in wedding toasts, retirement parties, eulogies, casual conversation, or joke books. Please note, the original authors of these jokes are unknown. The earliest extant versions of them are kept in a vault at the Friars Club in Los Angeles in the same room where they keep Buddy Hackett's mummy. Now, I would have been happy to present these jokes to you, but I realized that it would curse me to never hear laughter again and thus stop my nascent career in vaudeville and its tracks. So instead I've asked the actor Paul Rudd to come in and read them to you, because apparently he does not mind if he never hears laughter. Paul, I just want to say thank you for coming in here and cursing yourself to never hear laughter again. I really appreciate it.
Well, you know, what else is new?
Joke one.
A man goes into a bar. He has a dog with him. The dog is wearing an eye patch. The man says to the bartender, "Ask me about my dog." Unfortunately, the bartender does not hear him because he went deaf when he was a child. He serves a woman at the other end of the bar. When he comes around to the man with the dog again, the man orders an imported beer. He forgets what he was going to say about the dog. End of joke.
Thank you, Jonathan. And thank you, Paul. Let's go on to joke two, shall we?
All right. A priest, a rabbi, and a non-religious person are flying across the Atlantic Ocean, all for different reasons. There is engine trouble, and one of the wings catches on fire. The plane starts to go down. Luckily, there are enough parachutes for everyone. Evacuation is orderly. End of joke.
Thank you, Jonathan. When you're ready, joke three.
An Irishman, an Englishman, and an Indian chief go fishing together in a large rowboat in a medium-sized lake. Everyone has good luck, two or three big fish each. They stay out in the middle of the lake until sunset. On the way back to shore, as the sky purples and turns to night, they all sing a song. End of joke.
Thank you, John. Thank you. When you're ready, the next joke is fine.
A duck goes into a pharmacy. He says to the pharmacist, "I need some ointment for my beak. It is very chapped." The pharmacist says, "We have nothing for ducks here." End of joke.
Boy, that really wasn't funny at all. Nice job.
A dog goes into a bar. He's wearing an eye patch. The dog says to the bartender, "Have you heard the one about the one-eyed dog?" The bartender, who's deaf in one ear, thinks the dog is making fun of him. He asks him to leave. The dog says, "Don't you have a sense of humor, Deffy?" At the end of a shift, the bartender is tired of all the jokes. Today it's a one-eyed dog. Yesterday it was a horse with rickets. The day before, ants. He lives above the bar in a small room. He spends the night alone there, listening to his battery-operated radio, which picks up only a bad jazz station. He listens to bad jazz with his bad ear. End of joke.
Hey, Paul, thank you very much again. I really appreciate your coming by today and ruining your career in comedy as a result of reading these jokes aloud.
Can't ruin something you haven't started.
I should have thought that was pretty funny.
End of joke. Yeah, that was the end of my joke.
Let's hear it for Paul Rather. Emerson, fine brand of consumer electronics. So I've recently taken a contract to endorse a brand of consumer electronics. And let me say, Emerson is the finest out there. That is a mono-oral audio reproduction device. You can get it at Rite Aid for $29. You can take, it's also a personal music device you can take with it on the submarine. What did I just say?
I said you can take with it on the subject.
Brandon. We now come to the question and answer portion of the program. The book is written in sort of a voice of a character, kind of deranged know-it-all. And I found that when we did the Q&A, insofar as people have Qs and are looking for As, that sometimes people are kind of intimidated about what sort of questions to ask. They wonder, should I ask something in terms of the character? Should I try to be wacky or funny? I just don't feel that you should feel intimidated in any way, because the fact is that I'm just somebody who wrote a book, and I do other things that you might be curious about, or you may have other questions that you just are honestly curious about, and I would be more than happy to give you absolutely sincere answers out of character, or just as myself, and do it that way. You can imagine how this kind of intimacy would make me extremely uncomfortable. So the only caveat is that I ask that if we were going to do this at all, we do it by a walkie-talkie. All right, these are walkie-talkies. I hope you all know how to use a walkie-talkie. You would be surprised at the number of humans I've met who do not know how to use a walkie-talkie. Presumably because they were either born yesterday or grown in tanks. But just to quickly, I can really this allows me freedom of movement that, frankly, I find disturbing. You know, suddenly it's, this isn't reading, this is motivational speaking. Hi, everyone. How are you over here? Okay, well, I can't give you that, apparently. So here's the, to use a walkie-talkie, here's one. There's a yellow button on the side. To speak into it, you press down on the yellow button and hold it down. And when you speak clearly, and then say over, and then undepress the button. Here is an example. Hello, Jonathan. Can you hear me on the walkie-talkie? Over.
Yes, John, I can hear you just fine. Over.
And that is how, that is a successful talk. And I will call out, and you will know that I'm ready to hear a question when I say so. Please, if you do not have a question, please just keep the walkie-talkie moving right along. You will find the questions. If you do ask a question, when you're done asking the question, please just keep it moving along so that as many people who wish to might be able to ask a question via walkie-talkie. I regret that we will not be able to take follow-up questions. What was that? Very hard. Here you go, child. What age are you? I'm sorry, are you his mother? I'm sorry that I said fuck. There you go, you little bastard. Hello, this is John Hodgman broadcasting from the podium. Is there anyone out there who would like to talk by a walkie-talkie? Over. Oh, great. You were very quick. What is your name, sir? Over. And your question, sir? Curtis, did you say? Okay, go ahead with your question, sir. It's over.
What else is in that car? Over.
Question is, what else is it? Well, Curtis, is it another copy of my book? Can you just keep this in here always? Okay, this one's for you. Pay for it. There is a Cody's Book mailing list subscription card. That's for you. I'm not done speaking yet, that's why I did it. There's some pens. Who said that? Yeah, okay. And some yellow post-its. Actually, these are pretty good, these Sharpie metallic pens. Very silvery. Good apparently for signing computers, which I've been asked to do lately. And then some ripped up yellow post-its that have been scrawled on to get the pens working. There you go, sir. $2,400. Oh, no, sorry, just paper towels. There you go, that's for you. And then a piece of paper that says meditation on it. And then a piece of paper that says Hinduism on it. I'll give these out as well. That's for you. That's for you. You're welcome. Some crummy piece of wood. There you go. And a CD. Oh, post-its! It says alignment on it. Alignment viewing, planet spinning. It's some kind of, oh, it's a band. It's some kind of, yeah, I feel the same way. Does that answer your question? Over?
Yes, thank you.
Very good. Hi, Hi, this is John Hodgman. I'm ready to empty my pockets and the contents of Jonathan's pockets. If only you were curious to contact me via walkie-talkie. Over. Oh, hi. What's your name and where are you calling from? Over. Great town. What's your question, sir?
Over.
For those of you who didn't hear the question, the gentleman asked, how did I enjoy my hot dog with Bethany Clement last night? Which is not an extended euphemism. That is a legitimate question. Apparently the gentleman knows that Jonathan and I were in the city of Seattle last night, and we met someone that he knows, and we went to a place that served hot dogs, and is using this information to try to get into my brain and blow my mind somehow. Make me think that he's following me around and everything. Well, it won't work, sir.
Sorry to hear that.
What is your name again?
Chuck.
Chuck? It won't work. You will not destroy my brain. The hot dog is delicious. Over. Hi, it's John Hodgman calling from the podium. Is there anyone out there in the American dark who would wish to speak to me? Over. Hang on a second. Over. So, the first reading we did in San Francisco was, shall we say, ill-attended. It was fine, you know, that, you know, there was no television at that time, so and that was just fine, but it was a very polite crowd of 9 people, 12 maybe. It was a very friendly crowd. They smiled warmly throughout the entire thing. I always felt very welcome, but they simply would never, ever laugh. But the thing that really got me was when I was reading a portion of the book in which I enumerate various long and short confidence games, grifts and confidence games, including one, a street side game of chance called the Three Card Monte. And the Three Card Monte is very common in New York City. I've been stung by that particular game before, to my great shame. And as I was talking about the Three Card Monte, I realized, as I am realizing now, that no one knew what I was talking about. And I said, have you never heard of the Three Card Monte? And there was silence. And I said, is it because people in San Francisco are all so honest that they never con one another? And 2 people in the audience, they didn't say anything, they simply smiled and went. So, you know, the walkie-talkie's going around. I don't know why I would ask. I don't know what I would ask them, because I already have all the answers. I live in San Francisco. Are you still there, sir? Over.
Yes, I'm still here. Over.
Great, what's your name and where are you calling from? Over.
My name is Jeffrey and I'm calling from the second to the last row.
Awesome. You ever go to a little restaurant down there called Chino's? Well, you can eat breadsticks. It's great. Over.
Love that place. Great neighborhood joint. Over.
Great. So what's your question? Over.
So my question for you is that do you find that people are generally understanding of your celebration of hobo culture? Over.
I find that people generally are understanding. I find the need to make sure that people understand that when I am telling the history of the hobos and made up history of the hobos, that I'm not making fun of homeless people. The hobos that I'm talking about are a specific culture, self-determined, self-selected group of largely men who took to the rails during the Great Depression and became a politicized activist group that self-identified as hobos, and while they were certainly driven to that life initially by poverty, very quickly they took pride in that life and eventually very quickly became mythologized in America and became a romanticized movement, a sort of noble, wandering rejection of bourgeoisie. And that is a big tradition in American popular culture that I am referencing when I am making fun
of hobos. I don't even think I'm making fun of them. I'm sort of telling the same tall tales that, you know, Tennessee Ernie Ford tells when he's singing the song about the hobo who meets the gypsy and falls in love, and then they have sex and the entire universe explodes or whatever. Certainly there have been a couple, but very few people who think that I'm having a good ha-ha at the expense of, you know, homeless and mentally ill people who do not choose that life, and I really do not mean that at all. And then there are a group of people who occasionally will electronic mail me, very upset because I've said that the hobos have disappeared. And they say there are still hobos out there. And, you know, I'm all I can say is, well, and oh, there's still hobos out there, and I am one of them. And I'm like, wow, you're emailing me. And then a gentleman got very upset because I mentioned this in a radio interview, and he said, homeless people email all the time. And that's true, they go to libraries. And certainly, I suppose, actual hobos, because there are still people riding the rails, and they can have access to email. But they tend to be, in my experience, because one of these people is an old friend of mine from high school who turned up at a reading all of a sudden, hadn't seen him in years, and explained that he had been squatting and selling Foster Grant sunglasses and riding the rails as a neo-anarchist. They tend to be neo-anarchists. Sort of young kids, younger kids, older teenagers, young 20-year-olds, or whatever, who've dropped out of society and are turning their back on their parents' generation and making a political statement by living off of the land and the boxcars. And I respect this movement, and I think it's great and everything else, but in many ways, I feel that the hobos that exist today, including these young kids, and then there are older guys who still ride the rails and go to Grit, Iowa, and cook chili every year at the hobo convention and crowning king themselves king and being hobo or whatever. You know, they too are spinning a tale that contributes to the folklore of the hobo more. They're obviously, they are actually riding boxcars, but they are sort of taking on the mantle of this mythology as well. And so that is why I perhaps unkindly, but I think accurately describe these people in my book as hobos. But that said, if you want to jump on a boxcar and live your life there and take the risks that that entails, and it is rather risky, you are welcome to it. Just please stop emailing. Over.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else out there who would like to ask a question by a walkie, talkie? Over.
Yes, please. Over.
What is your name, sir, and where are you calling from?
I'm about, I think, off stage left from you, about 30 feet back, 40 feet back, and my name is Dan.
Do you have a GPS device?
Yes. Over.
Okay, go ahead. Dan, is it? Go ahead with your question, Paul.
I know Jonathan Colton has a great song about George Clinton, and you have that excellent ad, the Intellivision ad. And I was wondering if either of you has actually met him or talked to him or what the connection is.
The question is regarding George Clinton. Well, Dan, there is no connection primarily other than the fact that I'm a big fan of George Clinton, his work and his approach to life. While he was a sports enthusiast, and I am not a sports enthusiast, I still think that we found a certain amount of common ground in our love of stories and adventure, and I modeled very much my approach to sort of taking on any adventure that presented itself after he. I did meet him a couple of times in New York City, and had the pleasure, actually, of having a short story of mine bought for the Paris Review, and thinking that it would just be thrown in there, but in fact, he, in addition to being an amateur boxer, whatever, paper tiger, Detroit Lion, amateur television pitch man, and amateur movie star, was also a very fine editor, and actually had me on the phone for like 3 hours going over this short story of mine, like with intense scrutiny. I sort of, you know, shook my head and said over and over, what is going on? What? Okay, I'll buy the Intellivision. Are you really buying this? This is so strange. And then, and so I met him, and unfortunately, you know, he passed away. I met him not long before I saw him again, not long before then, at his house, where he would have these amazing parties on 72nd and
you know, right where the plane hit yesterday, almost a block away. I think that's where the Paris Review isn't based there anymore. It's in Fort Gray, which is the other thing you get downtown. So it used to be headquartered right there in George Clinton's house, and you'd have these parties, and, you know, it was young people would come, and he would, you know, give them candy and things. By candy, I mean brandy. You know, he had a great pool table, and he just take like 5 pounds of live carp and just throw it on the table. There was Brace. That was just crazy. Yeah, so, and then Jonathan decided he wanted to get a piece of this, so he wrote a damn song about it. So he never met George Clinton or anything, did you?
Yes, I did. Once at one of those parties.
Oh, I'm sorry to figure that. But maybe later you'll sing that song or another one. Over.
No, I can't actually play it on the guitar. Over.
But that's the fascinating part. I feel very bad because just tonight I took off this lapel pin that had been given to me by Keith Robinson, who was the lead programmer for Intellivision. I think a battery's on. Yeah, let's take some of that before we talk. But Keith Robinson was the lead programmer of Intellivision. It was the Blue Sky Rangers, I believe, was the group. Yeah, the group of programmers who created all those games. And what were the games, sir? I know you know them. I mean, baseball, obviously, but what else?
I keep wondering about your reference to Utopia.
Oh, you're moving on to another question of your own. Right. Yeah, Utopia. There was an Intellivision game called Utopia. And these guys, a few years ago, figured out that the Mattel had let the Intellivision brand name go. So they got back together, they got the old team back together, and they tracked down all the original programmers, and they all chipped in some money, and they bought the Intellivision brand name, and are now online marketing the old games on a single CD, and also a lot of the old George Clinton ads on a single, like on a CD combined. And that's sort of how I sort of reconnected with those ads, after thinking about them a lot since 1982. And I won't say that they're millionaires as a result, so I'm very happy because their marketing now amounts to giving me a little Intellivision lapel pin that I took off right before I came. I don't want to wear that tonight. It seems a little weird. But they're really nice, and I love the fact that they just bought this old brand. You know, Commodore 64 is bad. Did you know that?
Wow.
But it's like someone bought the brand. And now they're making coffee makers for them. What is it that they make? What is it? MP3 players? Yeah, they're not even making a console or a computer, right? It's just, you know, these brands are out there. And people, who is it that owns Grimm now? Like, Grimm was on the market for a while. And now they're bringing it out, and it's like, you know, a brand of sneakers or something. Like, yeah, people remember Grimm. Fill it to the rim. Wow, I got a big, there's someone applauding for Grimm there. Some people might not have gotten the walkie-talkie, so is there anyone over here who has questions? Anyone? Oh, wow, okay. I saw this woman here, yeah.
I love the piece Possible Man versus Hot Man for Sierra and Mike.
Yeah, thanks.
So I was wondering how you guys get there for it, and do you have now a new favorite?
The question is regarding a piece that I did for This American Life, in which I asked people on the street, mainly Jonathan and other friends of mine, random strangers that I found on the street, if they had to choose between two superpowers that they would have, one they would have one for the rest of their life, and their choices were the power of flight, the power to become invisible, which would you choose? And the correct answer is obviously invisibility. At the time, I was on the fence. Now I know the correct answer is invisibility. She asked if I have any where I've heard of it. I heard it in college, I think. Started talking about it in college. And then I don't have any better questions. That was a good one. For a while I was trying to think of another superpower pairing that you could sort of like the closest I came to was super stretching and super speed, because they both kind of suck. And I would ask, which would you choose, super stretching or super speed? Super speed. Yeah, I think that makes sense. See, it doesn't quite work. What's the opposite of super strength? No, not the
I was sympathetic to Dungeons and Dragons. I wanted to play Dungeons and Dragons. You know, I was. Are you? Oh, it's Rockin'. Hello. How are you? I didn't recognize you at first. I apologize. That's true. You did play Dungeons and Dragons in high school, didn't you? This is the first time I've seen her since high school. Yeah, very good. And what was your parent? You don't remember?
No, I don't.
What was your class? Your alignment? Anything? Well, anyway. Think it over. You remember. You were a thief.
Okay,
I think that's bullshit. Everyone who doesn't want to admit what their character was says, oh, I was a thief. Those thieves are cool. No, I thought it was a great idea. I was asthmatic. I hated sports. I loathed myself. I could not wait to escape into a fantasy world. And so it seemed like a great game. And then someone put some freaking hex paper in front of me. Do this math. And I'm like, that's no fun at all. I remember dedicating an afternoon that I was going to sit and learn this freaking game, finally. I'm trying to clean up my language. And I just could not get it finally. So I had to let it go. You know, I figured if I wanted to escape into a fantasy world, why don't I just sit quietly, you know, with some brandy. And think about being a, you know, a thief. I'll say I was a thief. Yeah. Was someone else back there? I mean, yes. Okay, you, and then we'll go, yeah. Just a couple more, I suppose. Sure, yes.
Do you find that people have asked us in the text about the players who want to ask a question more?
You mean, the question asked in an obviously fake British accent. Does my work as a resident expert interfere with my work as a professional author? Do you mean in terms of time? Or in terms of, like, ethical considerations?
Time, ethical considerations, also
do I get my work mixed up with one another? No, I mean, in terms of time, I now have, you know, I started out this year with like two dream jobs, like jobs that I had wished for my whole life. One was writing for the New York Times Magazine and helping edit the New York Times Magazine, which I still do. And the other was writing a book of fake trivia, which I never imagined anyone would allow me to do. And then all of a sudden, several more dream jobs emerged. Primarily this resident expert thing, the Daily Show, which was, everyone wants to applaud. Go ahead, applaud. Yeah. I know why you're here.
Oh, yeah, I love your book. John Stewart, really not sure.
You know, he's a normal-sized human being. You know, I don't find him to be particularly short at all. I'm surprised more people don't comment on the fact that he has a vestibular tail. That, to me, is out of the ordinary. But I guess we're not supposed to talk about that. So what I find myself is in a very weird situation of having now five or six dream jobs and very little time to bathe. I think it's become apparent to the people sitting in front of me. I don't know how long I will be able to tell them, so we'll see. Is there a question? Yeah, okay, sure. And then we'll go over here. I keep pointing at you people, I keep thinking, surely someone over there. Oh, that's coming. No, don't come up with something just for the sake of it. I can call on you, sir. And Zero, his head is made of furry old bronze. Yes, ma'am. Yes. No, it's not obvious. The question is, in the book, I say that, you know, if someone wants to make $1 million, and I don't know why this hasn't happened, because everyone wants $1 million, they will write a screenplay based on the premise of all animals attacking all things. It's like the birds plus everything else. And then the comment was, do you think snakes on a plane was sort of an embodiment of that idea? No, it's just snakes. I want fucking pumas. Mosquitoes, sloths, duck-billed platypuses, all of them on a tree. So I want them all on a tree. I want just, like, it's like, you know, zombies, everything against humans. Another question is, well, how do you get out of that school? How do you get out of that premise? And that's something for an actual writer. That's why I put it out there. It's like, come on, show me, because I want to see this movie. More serious literary novel. This guy? Yes, ma'am? Yes. Look at the glasses.
Oh.
The one is...
What if I take them off?
Okay, next. Please don't hold up your child. That's creepy.
Based on your expertise, may I have some advice about career options for somebody who studied Latin and Greek in college?
Yeah. Is your family very wealthy?
No, I come from an immigrant family.
That's very wealthy?
No.
You'd be a homo.
I teach Latin and Greek. You know, I studied literature, and no one wanted to pay me anything. But that's fine. What do you want to do?
I'm in law school right now.
Oh, there you go. There, that's my advice. Go to law school. I knew it would work out for you. And the Latin and Greek will come in handy. Because of, like, habeas corpus. Well, you don't need to know that. Ma'am, was there a reason you were holding up your very cute child? Did you want to ask me a question? Or
did
you just want to show me your child? Is that a boy or a girl?
Hi, Juliet.
Child?
It's a girl.
How old is she?
9 months.
Oh, hooray. Sorry I talked about masturbation.
Okay, that's a difference.
And did you have a question?
I did. I was wondering what it was like to work with They Might Be Giants, because I really admired your turn as the deranged millionaire.
Well, thank you very much.
Yes, it was fantastic.
It was surreal. I mean, it was absolutely, because I had been, like, it's like The Daily Show, which I had been a huge fan of. You know, They Might Be Giants, I had been a huge fan in college. And then I sort of said, enough of these guys. Then Jonathan got me back into them. And, like, had been following their career long after I'd given it up as a youthful fad. And I was like, wow, these guys are still brilliant, and they're still apparently alive. And then the McSweeneys started doing events with them, because they had the Giants had done an album for McSweeneys. And I had been conned into doing emceeing some of these events. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was just one surreal moment after another. They're both really nice guys. I mean, super nice, super down to earth. When I had read one of the radio attack ads in my book, which you learn about when you buy my paperback book, and I read it on a radio, Flansburgh, one of the two Johns of They Might Be Giants, said, you should come by, we should record those. And I'm like, what, are you crazy? You're a giant. You're a They Might Be Giants. But anyway, I went over and we recorded it, and he showed me the dial-a-song machine, which was exactly the same crappy cassette answer machine that I had had in high school. And I gotta tell you, his place was awful. Dirty, small, and cramped. And the sound system was kind of like this. You know, for a professional musician, I was surprised. You know what I mean? But he's a great favorite. And then we went walking afterward. I was walking the subway. He said, I'll come out with you. We're going to get some dinner. And he stopped and he started picking through someone's trash. Those speakers are really good. They shouldn't be throwing those away. Help me with these. I'm carrying these massive speakers that someone threw out. He's so happy. Maybe I've said too much. Two more questions and then we'll move on. Yes. Yes, you.
Me.
Yeah.
You know, I often wonder, do you listen to Neil Diamond? And if you did, or if you do, what's your favorite song of his?
I don't need to listen to Neil Diamond. I have Jonathan Coulton. America's greatest living song. Massachusetts, our house was perpetually tuned to WHDH, which at the time played soft rock. And so I'm very conversant with the songs of the Alan Parsons Project, for example, and Christopher Cross. And there was a lot of Neil Diamond going on as well. And I gotta say, you know, turn on your heart light, it still gets me. but otherwise.
That's my least favorite.
Really? It's funny how we're different. You know John, the work of Jonathan Bolton? Well, then we have
did
that.
You like E.T. then?
What's that?
Was it because of the attachment of E.T.?
No, I only learned about that later.
Really?
But I thought it was delightfully deranged for the arithmetic song about E.T. Wow. I thought he was crazy, but I had no idea.
I would have figured he was like a crackling rose.
You know what? Let's meet later. Yes.
I was wondering.
Yes. Yeah, the question is, did I actually spend time in prison in the United Kingdom? And yes, not a lot of time, overnight. It was, you know, in college. I showed up in London to work for a semester. I took a semester off. I went there to work, and I worked. I did work. I worked as a sort of telephone bank operator for a courier company. I worked as an usher at the Hammersmith Podium, which is the home venue of Motorhead. Saw Motorhead in concert. Also, yeah, it was open to that. And then I worked as a cheesemonger in London. But when I showed up in London, my friend Charles Diggs picked me up to the airport. He had been studying there. And he's an alcoholic, which at the time was funny. And he said, wow, thanks for picking me up so early. He's like, it's no problem. We stayed up all night, we got drunk, and we snuck into the London Zoo. I said, well, that's a terrible idea. You shouldn't do anything like that ever. That's crazy. You couldn't even caught anything for that. Said, no, it was awesome. We watched the sun come up and the birds chirp. Okay, whatever. And then months went on, and, you know, the life of a, you know, Hammersmith Odeon usher and cheesemonger was pretty grim. And I was staying with Charles for a lot of the time. He was in a dorm. And in the dorms in London, and dorms in British universities, they had bars in the basement. It seems a very good idea. It seemed like a great idea at the time. And suddenly I was drunk one night, and Charles said, I was really depressed about being there. I wanted to go home. I was very homesick. He said, let's sneak into the London Zoo. And I'm like, that sounds like an awesome idea. And so we did. We very swiftly got caught. Well, I got caught. We saw headlights coming down. I jumped over a low fence, and then I saw headlights coming. Like, I went down like this. I was hiding on the wrong side of the fence. And they said, who is here with you? And I thought I would protect my friend. I said I was alone. They said, no, we think there's someone with you. I said, no, I was alone. And they said, what's your name? And I thought, because I didn't have an ID with me. I didn't bring anything because I had a feeling this was going to happen. I brought nothing. I didn't bring my wallet or anything. The only thing I had was an onion that I had stolen from the store. Thrills. So he said, well, what's your name? And so I didn't want to tell him my real name, so I called him Steve Greenberg. You probably remember from high school. You don't? You don't remember? Not very well. He was a thief. And so they took me in, and then midnight, the guy came in, talked to him about the morning. Cop, they called him Bobby, came in. He said, you know, cute Bobby, you know this because you're British. You know how cute they are, they're not armed and everything. They're like, hey, governor. Here's how you get from A to B, and that's their whole job. And he comes in and he says, can you give me one reason why I shouldn't wrap my torch around your head right now? Well, governor. Like, what is your real name? And I see he's holding a piece of paper. And I see John Ogden, through, you know, written backwards through the light. And I'm like, how do you possibly know? And so they were very angry at me. I thought something bad was going to happen. The daylight came, and I wandered out.
well, at least if I'm 40, I get to go home. I heard this voice, John. I really thought I was going crazy. I said, fell away, John. Charles. And he was there. He was in the prison. He was two doors down from me. They said, yeah, they got me. I'm like, they did? I thought you, where were you? Where have you been all this time? I said, well, it's a long story. And what happened was he had gotten away. He, when the cop car came, or whatever, the security car came, he went face first down into the mud in the petting zoo. It was literally a pigsty. And they never found him. And then he, and there was another guy too with him. They ran, they got up, the coast was cleared, got up, they ran back to the dorm, immediately went to the bar, got a drink, and then said, John's been taken in by the police. We've got to go spring. He called every police station in London, saying, are you holding an American who was caught in the London Zoo? And he found Paddington Station finally. And they said, why, yes. Who's this? Well, my name is Charles Diggs, and I need to see him right away. And they're like, well, you ought to come down. And so he got a cab, got a bunch of friends, they all came down, he marched up to the stairs of the police station, and they said, I'm Charles Diggs, where's John Hodgman? And they're like, right this way, Mr. Diggs. According to all the people who were with him, they figured it out. All right, we're going. I was like, let me see him. And luckily, there had been a terrorist bombing at Paddington Station that morning. So, and Victoria Station. So they didn't have time to prosecute us. And they let us go. And the guy came, brought us in and said, okay, well, we're a little busy right now. So just repeat after me. We are idiots. And we will never do it again. And I've never gone to jail since. Nor have I committed any crimes. Well, I think that we can make stuff. I'm sorry. Well, we'll be signing afterwards. I'll be happy to answer any of your questions insofar as they are decent and below the input. But now we're going to close with a very, very short poem called The Hobo's Code. I'm sorry, you know, I hate poetry too, but I did not write this one. This is by Mindbender Steve, the Hobo Poet. The hobos did not leave much literature behind when they left. They didn't leave many records at all. They didn't write a lot down. Those who were not illiterate were very superstitious and especially distrustful of ink. The hobos considered ink, unlike chalk, to be a perversion to the world because it could not be washed away by rain and time, while forgetting would be an honor to the world, which of course forgets each moment as it passes and all of us as well. And in the makeshift rail yard camps called jungles, it was considered a virtue if you could purposely forget what had happened to you a week or a day or an hour before. And it was for this reason the exception, of course, was Mindbender Steve, the hobo poet, who scratched out tales of boxcar life in the margins of the newspapers that he had fashioned into undergarments. And from poems like The Hobo's Code, we get our really only intimate glimpse into the life and philosophy and practices of the hobo. The other hobos hated him for revealing their secrets and chased him around the country, attempting to kill him for many years. But he escaped over water where trains could not go and went to the place where all hated Americans go to be loved, France. And there he died. And he died there in the late 60s, but he wrote his obituary first. It was not a common, he wrote a regular obituary. He said, some think that it's a crime that I invented hobo poetry. All I can say in my defense was, at least it was not cowboy poetry. So the two things you need to know about this poem, The Hobo's Code, are this. One, it makes reference to the distinction that hobos made between themselves and tramps and bums. There's a very, the nuances of it I can't really explain, but the hobos took it very seriously and thought that they were better than tramps and bums. And then also, Mindbender Steve, the hobo poet, believed, as I believe as well, that all poems should rhyme, even when it becomes
painful. So you might notice that in this poem too. Oh, this one too. A hobo always goes and goes. He does not stop to change his clothes. He rides the rails that he has chose. Water pours out from a hose. Do not show me tramp or bum. Tramp may ride and bum's a chum, but both beg from the other one. Kids, stop chewing chewing gum. Neither works like hobo does, carving coin and twisting fuzz into a pretty pair of gloves. The past tense of to be is was. A hobo, he will never steal, unless it is to get a needle, or cash, or gems, or fur of seal. Some Japanese eat broiled eel. But saddest those who do not ride at all, but stand and die inside. As world spins on and throws aside the past and hope and faith and pride. In one direction do trains glide, not looking back on windward side, across the continent's divide, the hobo rides and rides and rides. I will eat anything that's fried.